Russia is acutely aware of this deep, long-running hostility and the desire to weaken and destroy Russia. Whether you say it's misplaced, exaggerated, it is beside the point. That is how Russia sees the picture. This is the psychology. And that is what was disturbing Professor Karaganov, because he said, if they don't fear our nuclear weapons, then they will go on ratcheting and ratcheting up until we are at war. So we have to bring back a certain degree of fear. That's why there is that sort of paradox, as I called it, or the oxymoron, of actually a nuclear fear can be the source of stability, particularly at a time when arms control has largely disappeared. All that, we talk about arms control, but it's meaningless. I mean, it hasn't been in existence for a long time because it didn't suit the United States to go on with arms control because they wanted to pursue a conventional war through Ukraine against Russia. In that way, then the arms control limitations would continue even as they were pursuing that war. And just take an example of this. This was very apparent. You remember when there was that spiderweb attack on on Russia's strategic nuclear aircraft on the tarmac. They were there because of the SALT treaty. They are supposed to hold their strategic bombers out in the open so that satellites, American satellites, can verify that they're still there and something hasn't changed. So they're kept out in the open. And that was the basis of that attack. It failed. It didn't work. It went wrong. But they had all of these containers and these vans brought into Russia with sliding roofs so that the missiles could be fired from the vehicles and hit the strategic nuclear force of Russia. Why would the United States think that this was a good idea? Because clearly it wouldn't have happened without the United States support. Why did they think if it was a good idea to attack its strategic nuclear power? Why would they have attacked in Voronezh, if you like, with their TACAMS, which is where Russia has its over-the-horizon radar systems at Voronezh? These are over-horizon about intercontinental war. They're not anything to do with Ukraine whatsoever. These are the raiders that are to give early warning of a nuclear exchange between the United States and Russia. Why attack those? Why attack the nuclear strategic bomber? Now, you can say, don't take it seriously. It's not so important. But, I mean, if you're sitting in Russia and Moscow, and you understand the significance of this, you will say, are the Americans, moving towards or preparing for the idea? They've already said publicly, the official responsible for it, that they believe American can win a nuclear exchange with Russia. And then that attack on Valdai, the Valdai compound, that also happens to be, if you like, the center, the control center, an underground bunker control center. It has the house of Putin there too, but it also is the command center for nuclear forces in the event of an exchange with another adversary.
You know, I'd like you to, because I think that you said something a minute ago that I think is so important for us to understand. We think Russia would never do this because they say Article 5, 32 NATO countries against one Russia. They would never survive that, so they never will. So we can do those things safely. But I want you to help us to understand the Russian mentality as exposed by Professor Karaganov, as you mentioned here, because he said one interesting thing I found very interesting from your article. This is what you put in there that he wrote. The use of nuclear weapons is a great sin, but the de facto refusal to use them is an unforgivable, deadly, and criminal sin because it paves the way for expansion and escalation of the world war unleashed by the West. If it is not stopped, it will most definitely lead to the destruction of humanity, including our own country. Vladimir Putin's question, and what is the point of a world without Russia, remains relevant. So when he says using nuclear weapons is a sin, but not using them is a greater sin, to what extent does that, impose on Putin's thinking, and how widespread is that in Russia?
Well, first of all, I mean, what he said too, and this is important to understand, because this directly affects particularly Europe. And he said, listen, we must understand the lesson from Iran, how the Iranians have used conventional weaponry, missiles, carefully chosen on vulnerable assets of the United States and Israel and the Gulf states. And that caused them to retreat. That brought a retreat. And so what he's saying is the first layer has to be conventional, Oreshniks. And he says we must build a range of missile capabilities for the future, Oreshniks, Bereshniks, all of these things for conventional power. But at the back of it always has to be some sense of real fear that there is ultimately, if none of those things work, the nuclear, I mean, the absolute last resort is a nuclear use. But to rule out or to allow that deterrence to fall away, to come into a disuse, is a danger. And I happen to think also that actually it is in a European interest for Russia to have a deterrence, because otherwise we will slowly, slowly, step by step, end up possibly in a major war with Russia by these little steps that Europe is taking every time. You know, first of all, it was drones, then it's attackams. They wanted to use Tomahawk missiles. Now they are using massive drones that are made in Britain, made in France. The actual drones or assembled in Ukraine, but made in Britain. These are British, if you like. Who's behind the plan? And this is why I'm saying it goes back to the decision makers. Who is behind this plan to do this escalation, to use the Baltics and Finland? You know, the Baltics are just, you know, minor in this. The big question Russia is looking at, who is the decision makers? And the decision makers are in Germany and in Britain and in France that are planning this slow escalation. You know what it's called. This is what the Russians think is happening, is that we are trying to boil the frog. You know the story. You boil the frog, you put the frog into cold water, and as you slowly increase the heat, after, you know, degree by degree, in the end, the frog dies. And so they think that this, what is happening, is a sort of boiling the frog exercise of escalation, small escalations. And so I think if this goes on, this is just my personal view, but if it goes on, I think there will be a reaction against the decision makers who are behind it. I mean, we know quite clearly it's not a surprise. They've already said this. And we don't know, exactly where the missiles launched from, but Naryshkin has said that they are actually being, that the Ukrainians are in Latvia with these drones. I don't know. Naryshkin is the head of the intelligence service, so he probably has quite good information. But even if they're not, it's not so much what's happening in the Baltic states. And there are, threats to go to the Kaliningrad Peninsula or anything like that. It's who is they have to, as they see it, have to send a painful and clear message to decision makers. Those decision makers are largely in Europe. it's European driven, this move towards war with Russia. But just like as we've heard about, you know, the war on Iran, you know, the question is, why would it be in a European interest to go to war with Russia? What for? How could it be in a European interest? Well, it has been a European interest for a long time. From, the war Europe has been fighting Russia. I mean, from Germany, it was from Napoleon, from Germany. Britain was the only one who was not, but Russia had almost the entire of Europe fighting it in the Second World War. And, you know, they don't intend to be boiled in the pot. So they are looking for ways, conventional ways, like the Iranians have done, to send a very clear message, that in that case, sending a message to Washington saying, look, you know, pull back, because otherwise we will escalate and it will be extremely damaging for our economies, your economies, the world economy. And if you don't listen to the message, draw back, pull back from this exercise in Iran and pull back from this attempt to slowly escalate into something much more serious across Europe.
Let me ask you a little follow-up question on what you just said there, because I hear what you're saying about why, because the obvious question that any normal person would ask was, why would the West, Europe, U.S. want to do this boil the frog thing to try and move closer to a conflict with Russia when Russia clearly does not pose a conventional threat to attack the West on their own initiative? So there is nothing to deter or limit from coming from them. But as you pointed out, I mean, you went back to Napoleon, to Hitler, et cetera. There seems to be this longstanding desire in the current form, because we've seen World War One and World War Two and the massive destruction, and now with the destruction power profoundly higher, any third attempt would be massively more in casualties for Europe. What is animating the individual today to even want to play with the boil the frog theory?
Well, because, I mean, you know, you ask a very complex question, but really it goes back to things that have happened in the past. It was called the Pale of Settlement, and it led to a huge emigration. First of all, to a radicalization of population that were in these pales of settlement, which were mostly in Poland, led to quite a radicalization in the Pale of Settlement. And many of those people arrived in America, but also many of them went to Palestine, to Israel. And many came to Europe, and those people were part of a generation, the young people who were radicalized, really radicalized against the Tsar and against the government in Russia. From the 1860s onwards, it became, you know, the younger generation rose up against their parents, essentially, and became Trotskyists and became Bolsheviks, and were throwing, you know, nail bombs into cafes in Russia. But then Stalin came and repressed it, and, if you like, sent people to the camps in Siberia. And there's a huge anger and resentment for what they call pogroms before. I'm not saying there weren't pogroms, but many of them were not, you know, the pogroms that took place or claimed to take place in Ukraine. Many of them were actually done by the Greeks, who resented competition and things in these areas. So there's a sort of deep history of desire for revenge for what happened during the Stalin period and after the Bolshevik Revolution. And this has been long standing. And, you know, Europe financed these the Bolshevik Revolution. European banks financed the Bolshevik Revolution. They financed the war against Russia, the Japanese war that defeated Russia. They financed the Ukrainian, if you like, war against Russia. And ultimately, you know, this is at the forefront of the screen for many Russians. They see this and understand it. It's not sort of our take on the world. And we say, you know, well, is it real? Is it something that we should take seriously? Well, I think we should take it very seriously. I've always felt, you know, that the most important thing in geopolitics, which I try to practice too, is to put yourself in someone else's shoes and see the world not just from your vision, not from the inside, but from the outside. So the huge change that can take place politically and in geopolitical understanding is when suddenly for a moment you see actually the inside has an outside and the outside is a different view. And that if you've got to understand that to find a solution to the apparent contradiction of holding opinions and views that are facets that are completely contradictory.
And as long as we fail to do that, I mean, you have all kinds of problems because we live in this, I don't know about in Europe as much, at least in the United States, we live in this almost bad, like a virtual reality. We program in what the other side is, and then we wear these goggles, and we don't even see what really is going on, which has pretty bad consequences.
So this is, and the consequences could be very serious with this. If we ignore what, you know, and you said, is the paper by Karaganov serious? Yes, I'm trying to say to you, this is, you know, yes, when he first started talking about this nuclear issues, it was considered to be a little bit out of an outlier. It is now dead central. This is the thinking. This is why the Russians have just had a major nuclear. This is the first step. A major, look at it. It's been a massive demonstration of nuclear power that has taken place. People will say to you, oh, was it probably scheduled a year ago? No, it was put on particularly now to say to the West, don't forget, we are a nuclear power. And if you think you can just ignore this by going on sort of bit by bit, dissecting us and taking us to pieces, continuing to use Ukraine as a battering ram to destroy Russia. And what that's saying is, you know, Europe is using Ukraine to prevent a settlement. I think that was so obvious during that period when Witkoff and Kushner were going back and forwards. I mean, every time, you know, the Europeans would call a meeting and then they bring Zelensky in and say, no, we can't have this. We can't have this at all. They have to continue. There can't be anything. There can't be a settlement. There can only be a unilateral ceasefire. That's all that is acceptable. And it didn't resolve the issues. The issue fundamentally about Ukraine is the same one. It's Russian security. They need to know what is the limit of NATO's, if you like, where is the border of NATO? How far does NATO extend? And to say on the other side, this is Russia, China's Asian frontier. We have to have some understanding. You know, it just, NATO goes on and on, expanding, taking different views. And the Russians are saying, you know, we have to halt this. We have to have a serious discussion. So Karaganov's final point, I mean, is something very simple. We have to talk about this. We have to talk about, again, which we don't do and haven't done for some time. We have to talk about, you know, understanding each side's perspective on the nuclear issue and on conventional weapons. It may not end up in a treaty, but something needs to be managed. There needs to be someone who possibly is even a, you know, someone with some weight or standing in their society that can come and say, you know, this is how we need to understand each other. Let's have sort of entente.
Gary, if I could get you to pull that previous headline back up there, the one you just had about Putin will only use it as a last resort. That, I think, is more important than it appears at face value. I'd like your view on this. I know we're just about running out of time here. But taking a look at what this headline is here, reading it from Western eyes, Putin says only use nuclear weapons would be a last resort. So when we hear that, we think, oh, well, and unless we attack them first, then they're not going to use nuclear weapons. So we don't have to worry about it, all this kind of stuff. But it depends on the definition of last resort. You said a second ago, you got to look at the other side and think the way they do. We're thinking the way we do. But here is Karaganov. I perceive, and you tell me if you think I'm wrong, I perceive he's putting that definition of last resort in a different context. Here he is with Glenn Deason.
We have restored our soul and our honor. We have started to value those people in our society, which are truly valuable, meritocratic elites, scholars, doctors, officers. The country is becoming more healthy. But for that, we are paying for too many bodies. So my advice to my government is that we should stop this war, at least in Europe, by going up the ladder of escalation, first attacking by commercial weapons, symbolic or logistical points on European soil. We not need an inch of Europe, as you might understand. And then if they do not succumb, we should follow with nuclear strikes, relatively mass, with, of course, offering some kind of ultimatum. If they do not succumb, some of the countries of Europe should perish.
Now, whether Putin holds that view or not, I don't know. But when he says last resort, that means we'll fire conventional weapons at these points because of all the things that have happened in the last 4+ years. So when he says last resort, that seems to be different than what Americans are thinking. How do you see that context?
I mean, he puts it in the context of we need to learn the lessons from Iran. Iran used not necessarily the most powerful conventional weapons, but conventional weapons to send a very clear message, striking at a vulnerable asset, but not destroying everything, to send a message clearly and saying retreat. And largely the West did retreat. And he is, Karaganov is saying, very much the same message is saying, look, we've tried it verbally and said to, you know, we put statement after statement out saying we won't accept this. And people say, oh, it's bluff. We don't pay any attention. We won't pay any attention. We'll just continue. We'll continue on soldiering. And he's saying, if they don't stop, if they don't hear that we do have limits, that there are boundaries that you cannot cross. And if you cross those boundaries, first of all, we will deliver a pointed message in terms of a conventional weapon. If it goes on and you don't pay any attention, we may then use a tactical weapon to underline the last resort is that we are a nuclear power. I'm not trying to present the Russian case. I underline, I'm presenting the European case because I'm presenting the case that Europe actually has no interest in going down this route. It should actually come to some understandings about where the limits of security lie. Where are the limits of NATO action? Where are the limits that China and Russia and Iran can pretend to. If without that, I mean, it becomes chaotic and it becomes unmanageable and can easily deteriorate. We have no interest in sort of pushing this to the limit. Now, Karaganov clearly, and I say I've discussed it with him, he is creating a psychological atmosphere, but a real one. He's creating a psychological atmosphere. He believes it's important that Americans and Europeans understand that a deterrence is deterrent, and it has to deter. If it doesn't deter, it's a waste of time. And so he's trying to underline the importance that for Russia, nuclear power is seen as a major deterrent.
And just final question here, what is your best assessment for how close we are if Putin would do it, not Karaganov, but Putin would say, all right, it's crossed my red line. Europe has apparently no intention of changing anything that they've been doing for the last 4.5 years. That Putin would say, all right, that's it. We're going to try the Karaganov method, conventional missiles at various sites in Europe. How close do you think we are to that?
Quite close. If this escalation goes on, I mean, how many missiles? You know, first of all, it was Ukraine threatening the 9th of June victory celebrations in Moscow with a massive attack, which then Putin spoke to Trump, and Trump got it called off. And then we had a massive drone attack on Moscow, probably the one that was intended for the 9th of June, which was pulled back on Moscow. Yes, it didn't happen on the 9th of June. They just saved it up and did it a few days later. Either the Europeans pull back the Ukrainians on this and say, no, here are the guidelines. We have to manage this. You can't simply just escalate and escalate and escalate with drones and with, and as I underline, you know, these drones are storm shadows. And drones, I mean, they are cruise missiles produced. They may be transshipped to Ukraine in crates and put together again in Ukraine. But fundamentally, these are European weapons being used directly on Russia. You can't get around that. These are European weapons facilitated and assisted to strike deep into Russia. How long does Russia put up with that? I don't think it'll go on forever putting up with that. I think it's been pretty patient so far. And as a European, I think we should respect that deterrence. And I think that deterrence is actually something that serves us, because we don't want the frog to get boiled.
Indeed. Indeed we don't. Instead, I couldn't put it any better myself. Thank you so much for coming on today, Alistair, and really laying this out in honest way. Just remind people to go and read this whole article on the Conflicts Forum. There's the address you see on the screen, conflictsforum.substack.com, and read all this stuff, because there's constant new material we put out there. So thank you very much, Alistair. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And we appreciate you guys as well. There's going to be one more short show today. Something that's been kind of in my craw. You'll see it on the schedule here coming up shortly. Take a look at that. I'll be back off of the – we're going to do the intelligence brief tomorrow. By the way, we're going to still stick with that. So I'll do one more here from vacation with my family on Saturday morning, the intelligence brief. Otherwise, we'll see you back in my studio Monday morning on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. See you then.
You know we don't have sponsors because we hate to hit you over the head with ads. I don't like them. So show a little love back. Subscribe, like, and send this to somebody you care about.